Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, Knicks? What the fucksters? What's happening? It's Mark Maron. This is my podcast. How are you? It's called WTF. Welcome to it. If you've never been here before, how's it going? Mary Lou Henner is on the show today. And hopefully, if everything works out correctly, Danny DeVito will be on Thursday. Kind of a taxi-themed week. Just works out like that sometimes. We'll see. I have not recorded the Danny DeVito talk yet. Anything could happen between now and when I have to record that, but that's the plan. Can you dig it? Okay. Also, had some date confusion, day and date confusion last, What day is it? On Thursday, when I announced my dates, I'm going to do it again correctly. If you want to come see me, I'll be at the Merriam Theater in Philadelphia on Thursday, October 10th. The Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. on Friday, October 11th, and the Schubert Theater in Boston on Saturday, October 12th. All right, then I'm heading to Nashville at the James K. Polk Theater on Friday, October 18th, the Tabernacle in Atlanta on Saturday, October 19th, and the Masonic in San Francisco on Saturday, October 26th. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets, but I am going to be taping my special on... This is going to be on October 30th at the Red Cat Theater here in L.A. It's a nice black box theater. We're working on how it's going to all work there, how you can get tickets or whatever. It's not huge. It's going to be an intimate affair. It's going to be unique, and I'm going to talk to you. That's how it's going to go down. So if you want to free that date up to come, please do. Tickets aren't quite available yet, but they're going to happen. I'll let you know as soon as that happens. All right. Holy shit. Isn't this exciting that President Scumbag is being taken to task in a seemingly legitimate way? No, I'm going to pull seemingly right out of that sentence and say legit. This is some legit sort of unconstitutional fucked up behavior for a president. Yeah. Not that that's a surprise, but it looks like it's got teeth. And it's very exciting. I can't say satisfying because with the power of the propaganda machine, these worms will worm out of anything. But it looks like the screws are being put to them pretty good, and that's very satisfying. And I'm sorry if this upsets any of you, even you people that somehow rationalize or justify this guy just because, you know, you're doing okay or because you're a Republican. If you really, really, what it comes down to, if you support this guy unconditionally or even conditionally, you're sort of anti-American. You don't believe in our system. And that seems to be the truth of the whole matter. But the more these people defend this guy, no matter what, the more clear it is that they fundamentally don't believe in the American system of government. And that makes them un-American. They can scream socialist and this and that all they want, but they are fundamentally un-American if they don't take this guy to task in a real way. So that's how I see it. That's how I'm going to frame it. So look, folks, it's been a pretty good few days for me if I look at it correctly. I've worked a long time. I've worked hard on a few things outside of my comedy, outside of this podcast, things like playing guitar, things like acting. And there's been some kind of, I can acknowledge and see that I did all right. And that's a good feeling. If you do something and you succeeded at it, or you look at it and you're like, did a pretty good job there, take a minute and appreciate it. Will you? Because what else? Like, I mean, there's more to life, but Jesus Christ, you work hard on something and it works out. You should go like, oh, look at that. I did that. And it happened last week. Patrick Stickles, Titus Andronicus, a guy who I like a lot, who's been on the show a couple of times. I like his music. He plays hard. He's an earnest motherfucker. He's smart. He's funny. He's tormented. And I like him. He's from New Jersey. We've always gotten along pretty good, and that's always nice to hear from him. He was playing here in L.A. at the Bootleg Theater, and I was doing comedy that night, but he said, come down and play Neil Young's Keep On Rockin' in the Free World with me. And I'm like, all right, I think I can do that. And then, like, I learned the chords. I know the songs. I go and he tells me to throw my gold top in the car, my Deluxe, my Gibson, Les Paul. And I did. And then I get there and I just got all chicken shit. I got to the gig, it's packed out, they're about to play, and I didn't bring my guitar in. I didn't want to be the guy that walked in with his guitar to play one song. So I asked him earlier, it's like, if I don't bring it, do you got one around? He said, yeah, we'll set you up. But I got there, and they had a jazz master out for me, a Squire jazz master. It might have been the J. Mascus model. I didn't check. I was more focused on just the nerves of playing the song. And they rock pretty hard, you know. They're a punk rock outfit, but it's pretty solid rock and roll stuff. It's good. He's having a great show. It was a great night. And they were about to close up, and I knew, I guess I should have figured, it was going to be the last song that I was going to play with him, and their last song for the night. And I realized right before that, the song before the last song, that I wasn't quite clear on some of the changes. So in a panic, I ran out of the room where the show was, and I pulled it up on Apple Music, the song, and I listened to it just so I kind of had it in my head. And then he called me up on stage, and we fucking did it. And to be honest with you folks, and I don't like being this honest, but I think I've watched it like 15 to 20 times a day, every day since I played it, just me playing that lead with a real rock band. And I get a kick out of it every time because I fucking nailed it. And I feel pretty good about that. I feel pretty good about my ability to land a fairly solid solo on someone else's guitar with someone else's equipment in a great song. But that guitar sounded good. So my point is, all my practice has paid off. I can fucking at least 3 out of 5 times land a fucking pretty searing solo. That's all I'm saying. Proud of myself. Is that okay? Yes, I call them President Scumbag. So what else happened? Last night I went to the Joker premiere here in Los Angeles. It was exciting. It was kind of fun. I got dressed up. I went with Lynn Shelton. She got dressed up. You know, we drove up. It was high security. They closed off all of Hollywood Boulevard. There were plenty of fans on the street. But, you know, there was this whole chunk of the street just empty. And it was massive security. Got out of the limo. Did the, you know, picture line. There was no reporters there. It was all photos. Just walked the line. Kind of hung around. I finally got to sort of connect with Joaquin a bit because we didn't really do it on set. He gave me a hug. And had a couple laughs. And then we went into, and then Todd Phillips, of course, the director. So the movie itself, had not seen it, was very excited to see it. Nice, there's a nice build to it. And it looks great. Joaquin is great. And boy, the end, man, the end definitely delivers. I'm very limited in what I can say. But I will say this, my scene is not as long as it was shot. And I, you know, these things happen, but it made sense. I text before the last week, I texted Todd Phillips, the director. I said, am I still in the movie? And he said, the walk and talk is out, but yeah, the dressing room scene is there and you're there, you know, you're in parts of the end of the movie. And I'm like, okay, so the walk and talk is out. Why is that? And he said, because there's not a shot in this entire film that doesn't involve Joker, doesn't involve Joaquin, whether it's his point of view or whether he's in it or whether it's something in his head, that the one scene where he wasn't in it was when me and De Niro were walking down the hallway towards the dressing room. Seeing it on the big screen, knowing that you're doing the work in the present, you can only feel what you feel. But seeing it, like, I did it, man. I held my own in that moment, in that little scene. I acted right. You know, I took Todd Phillips' note, you know, when he gave me direction, which is basically, you know, De Niro's your boss. And I was very happy with the performance. It was very tight. I showed up. I'm definitely in it. So that was exciting. Go see the movie. I think you'll enjoy it. But it's not, it doesn't open until next Friday, I think. But it's something. He's something, that Joaquin Phoenix. Talk like my father. That Joaquin guy's something. So look, let's talk about our guest that we're going to enjoy right now. Mary Lou Henner wanted to do the show. I ran into her in a theater. I can't remember what show we were seeing. Maybe Death to Kill a Mockingbird, or maybe it was Hamilton. I don't remember, but I saw her, and she saw me, and she was very excited, and she wanted to come on the show. So today's her day. So Taxi, the show that kind of made her, first premiered 41 years ago this month, okay? And the plan here is to talk with Danny DeVito tomorrow and have that episode for you on Thursday. So this is me talking to Mary Lou about Mary Lou and the arc of Mary Lou. And she's pretty lively. So enjoy this. And also, by the way, well, I'll tell you at the end. Enjoy this. It's Mary Lou Henner.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Do you want to wear cans?
Yeah.
Ex-radio person.
I know.
How long did you do morning radio?
3 years.
It's like, it turns you upside down, right?
You know, and then
like 6 o'clock, you got to be on the air?
At first I was doing 5 till 8.
Yeah.
And then I was doing 8 till 11.
Well, that's easier.
And then that was a lot easier.
At what stage do you decide to do radio?
You know, I've always loved interviewing people. I used to sit in my backyard. I had a very crazy upbringing, but yeah. I used to sit in my backyard and interview people with my hairbrush.
Really?
And my
Barbies. Fictional people or real people?
Like neighbors and kids that I knew.
Because you saw it on TV?
Because I saw, I was obsessed with the Tonight Show.
Oh, really?
And so I
like Carson's Tonight Show?
Carson's Tonight Show. And I got to do it with him a few times too,
I know.
Which was so great.
But
I was just always into, I'm so naturally curious about other people.
Yeah.
I'm always trying to like really get to know people
right.
and everything. I'm just very pro extrovert,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll talk to the person next to me on the airplane. You know?
Oh, yeah. You're that person?
Like Conan has a whole routine.
He does.
That.
I find that I don't do it hardly at all anymore, but mm-hmm. I find that when it does happen is literally like 14 minutes before landing.
Oh,
like you could
that's
not
safe.
Talk to some. I guess that's what it is. I don't know, but I could not talk to somebody for 5 hours.
Right.
And then out of nowhere, it just the conversation starts to happen.
Go. But maybe you don't go to the bathroom a lot. I like a window
I do go
seat.
To the bathroom. No, and you go to the bathroom a lot? And you like the window?
Enough. Yeah, I like the window.
I like the aisle because I like to go to the bathroom and I don't. Yeah.
Now I'd have to talk to you to be able to crawl over.
That's right.
I have two sons, 23 and 25. The 25-year-old, Nick, he loves the middle seat. He feels it's the best of both
really?
Worlds. And he can be on a plane.
He's like, people be so happy for him to travel.
I know. He wants to do, he's a filmmaker and he directs videos and stuff. And he
How old is
to be
he?
A director, 25.
Just and he's a middle seat guy?
Middle seat guy since he was little.
I've never met a middle seat person.
He wants to do a whole documentary on
the middle seat. It's a great title.
The benefits of the middle seat.
Just call it the middle seat.
The middle seat. And he feels like even if there's nothing, well, he likes to talk to people.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
You made another one.
I made two of them.
Yeah.
Both
talkers.
Both of my kids. The one is a little less of a talker. In fact, my son Joey, who's 23, wants to be a comedy writer, in a writer's room, improv, graduated from Northwestern, unbelievably funny.
Well, you're from Chicago, right?
Chicago.
That's where Northwestern is.
Yes. I went to University of Chicago, but went to Northwestern.
So what does it look like when you're growing up? You just told me that you had skunks as pets?
No. This is what happened. I'll give you my little speech about my upbringing, and then you can take it from there.
What, does it have to be in the form of a speech?
No, but it's sort of like—
See how many times you've done this?
You see? People. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It just says it all in like a few sentences.
Well, we have more time.
Okay. That's what I like about your podcast.
Give me the encapsulated few sentence speech
and then
on your upbringing.
You can sort of like, okay.
We can unpack
it
from there.
I'll try to make it sound fresh.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was the heart of the city. Do you know Chicago?
Sure, little bit.
Logan Square? Do you know Logan? It's so hipster groovy now.
Is it now? Yes, I do. I actually do know Logan Square.
Heart of the city, mm-hmm. You know, the Kennedy Expressway just missed demolishing my house mm-hmm. when I was a little girl because they were building it and everything else. So
was there pushback and protests? Like, don't post?
I don't know. I was four, five. But it was—
You should know, though. You have that memory thing.
I know. I remember. I remember when it opened. So we lived on the boulevard, and you aren't allowed to have a commercial property, or you couldn't back then anyway.
Yeah.
And so, but it didn't matter because my mother was very close friends with the alderman.
Uh-huh.
And we were even like the house where, you know, people went to vote.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
It's always weird when you got to go to a house to vote.
To vote.
Yeah.
So, but my father built this garage, a fake garage, which is, you know, that's why I laud you for doing this in your garage, because I grew up as a garage kid. My mother ran a dancing school in our garage, and it was 200 students from the neighborhood between the ages of two.
The hell of a big garage.
It wasn't. It was like 2.5 cars.
So she ran a few classes. No,
yeah,
there was
classes.
Never 200.
No. Baby classes, old classes.
She was a dancer.
A dancer. And we all danced. We all, as soon as you were 14, put to work, you had to have a class. So there were—
You had to teach.
You had to teach. Oh, I danced since I was two. So yeah.
What kind of dance? 14. Ballet?
Tap, ballet, jazz. My mother taught modern dancing, you know, like jazz.
You can tap?
I can tap.
Have you tapped with Christopher Walken?
No.
Oh, you should. Maybe that's something you should do before.
I know. I aspire
to
tap with Christopher Walken.
Do you have any memories of Christopher Walken?
I do. In an elevator in, we were both staying at the Viva Hotel.
Yeah.
The Viva, like apartments in Vancouver in 1996.
When you were shooting?
I was shooting the Titanic. I don't know what he was shooting. He had red hair. Crazy hair. And so we'd run into each other in the elevator.
The Titanic? Not Titanic.
The Titanic miniseries.
Ah.
That starred, that my husband at the time was directing, Robert Lieberman. I played Molly Brown.
Yeah.
Unsinkable Molly Brown.
Right.
I had two little kids. One was six.
Yeah.
Joey was six and Nikki was, had just turned two.
Right.
And but it was like Peter Gallagher and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Uh-huh.
It's what introduced her to
the world.
American public.
And you had a elevator moment with Walken.
A couple of them.
Yeah.
Laundry room.
How was that?
Great. It's like, yeah. Well, I was married to Frederick Forrest. He was my first husband.
From
so
Apocalypse
a lot of those
Now.
And The Rose.
Yeah.
So a lot of those guys that were that group, you know, knew me from that.
How old were you when you were married to Frederick Forrest?
28.
Yeah.
He was much older.
He was much older?
Well, it's up 43.
And you were 28 and he was 43?
Mm-hmm.
44.
Yeah.
And you met on that movie?
We met on a movie, the movie Hammett, at the
that's
screen
what I mean.
Test.
Yeah.
January the 5th, 1980. I won't do dates all the time.
But you had no kids with him?
No, I had no children. I was only with him 2 years.
Oh, that bad, huh?
Bad enough. you either want a marriage that's bad enough that you're out in 2 years, or good enough that you're in.
Well, it's glad it wasn't one of those slow percolating bads.
No.
Yeah.
No, he talks about it.
In a bad way.
He definitely. You know, he was an alcoholic, and I'd never. You know, I'm so like sunny.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, that's okay. Well, you know,
was that your first alcoholic?
Yes, kind of boyfriend. Yes, it's a shock.
Yeah,
a
but
shock.
Do you find that are you attracted to people with the compulsive sort of addictive?
I'm attracted
issues?
To people. I'm attracted.
Well, I understand.
No,
that.
I don't think. No, I don't, you mean like the fix it type? I don't know. I've had my issue. I've had my relationships over the years with people who were
fixer
dark
uppers
and complicated dark. And yeah. thought like, oh, you know, and they're attracted to me, so I'm attracted to them, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you were the dark and complicated.
the dark whisperer.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a full-time job.
Yeah. No, one of my brothers has been in and out of rehab a few times. In fact, I'm one of six siblings, and five of us went to Betty Ford and spent the week there and went to, and they said they've never seen that happen to, with a family.
You like, were at
so
Betty
many
Ford?
People. My brother was.
Five of you, though. What's
but
five of you?
Five of us went yeah. there for family week.
Oh, I thought you were patients, and I was
no,
like, oh,
no,
my God.
No, we got a discount.
Yeah.
No. He talks, he wants to do a Zagat guide on rehab.
Oh, he does? For rehab?
He's a real character.
Oh, yeah. Your brother? How many you got?
Two
five?
Brothers. There's two boys and four girls.
Everyone's still
I was
around?
The third. Yeah.
That's
yeah,
nice.
Our parents died very young, tragically, both of them. But the siblings are all still together.
So there's a dance studio in the garage.
Dance studio in
You're
the garage.
You're teaching at 14.
200 there's, students.
There's tapping and there's ballet?
Nuns. Oh, I thought you said ballet. This is a lower middle class neighbor in Chicago.
No ballet?
No ballet. You can park on the boulevard.
Ballet? There's ballet?
Ballet, tap, jazz, social dancing.
I can see you doing jazz.
Oh, yeah. I did Fosse for a year on Broadway.
You did?
I did Chicago.
I remember that.
408 performances
of Chicago.
I did it on Broadway.
Yeah.
And I replaced Annie Reinking, so I was the first replacement. And so I went in, I did the show with B.B. Newworth and Joel Grey and Jimmy Naughton. And then they asked me to go to Vegas, and I thought, oh, Vegas, I don't want to go. And then they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I was like so excited. I went, okay, yeah, that sounds like a deal. So I went there, I took my two little boys, they were 3.5 and 5 at the time, and we had the best time. They got us a house. The boys learned to swim. They got their yellow belts in karate. It was fantastic in Vegas. And I got so complimented because I was at the Mandalay Bay and the people were saying, oh, you're great. Whoa, we love you here. And this. And I was like, oh, you like the show? And he was like, no, we sell a lot more Belvedere with your crowd. Nothing
it's all
to
about
do with
the
show. It's all about the booze.
Getting them back
Top
out
shelf.
To the casino. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird. I don't, was that the first time you worked in Vegas?
Yeah, the only time.
Oh, really?
It was in 99 and it was really fun. I had a great time. I mean, they had to drag me kicking and screaming to go.
Yeah.
And then they had to drag me kicking and screaming out of there, but the boys had to start school, so I had to do it.
Yeah,
but I had a blast. They gave us a bungalow with the
When you get first class treatment in Vegas, I imagine it's really first
the
class.
Misters, you know, you take your kids to the wave pool and the lazy river and all that other stuff. No, we
loved
had a great
it.
Time, and the audiences were great.
Yeah,
they loved the show, and we did the same show we did on Broadway. But it is kind of funny when you're doing a second show on Tuesday, and you're about to start the second act, and it's midnight.
Yeah.
You know, and you're doing Me and My Baby. If you
right.
Know
Right,
and it's like crazy.
There's no time in Vegas.
No, it's there's just no time.
Yeah,
no time.
So okay, so it's you start okay. dancing.
I start dancing.
Are you the youngest? Where are you in the
no,
middle?
No, I'm the third. There's a
okay.
My parents were married 5 years, then they had a girl.
Yeah.
Another 5 years, they had a second girl.
Yeah.
Another 5 years, they had me.
Yeah.
And then the next year, a boy. Next year, a girl. 3 years later, a boy.
Was it? So that seems like an interesting pacing. So
it was
a lot of space.
They had. My mother gave birth to babysitters. You know, she gave birth to me, and then
that was the plan.
13 months later, she gave birth to the first boy.
Yeah.
You know, the little Buddha. So my older sister kind of raised me. But we grew up, I mean, it was such a great way to grow up because it was not only a dancing school, but my mom ran a beauty shop out of our kitchen. Where
the whole house is a business.
The whole house was a business. 25 women from the neighborhood would come over and get their hair done.
But were there
in the
signs
kitchen.
Or is there just a known thing?
Just a known thing. Everybody came over. Everybody hung out at my house. My parents
all
were
all under the
incredible.
Table.
Totally.
Yeah.
but not, you know, for a dollar a student, and my mom would charge, you know, $3 for a
kept
her
busy, though, right?
I grew up with such a great role model about wanting to do a lot of different things and being an entrepreneur. And
what about food? Who's feeding everybody?
She was, but as my uncle used to say, as a cook, she was a very good dancer. Mm-hmm. You know? But I liked my mother's cooking because it was very simple. She was Greek.
Uh-huh.
My father was
Greek's
Polish.
Greek's the best.
I just went there for the first time.
I've never been there, but Greek food, I love it. So clean,
so
fish.
Clean.
I like fish.
Fish. I like horta, which is the greens.
I like
the
horta,
greens.
The greens. They're just
the
like
greens.
Dandelion greens or
yeah.
something.
Yeah, and I love the white beans.
Have you had that dessert, Galik de Borco?
I don't eat dairy. I haven't had dairy since Today is my 40th anniversary of not having dairy, August 15th, 1979.
I hardly eat it because it just seems like pure fat to me.
Oh, but not only that, it just weighs you down. It's the hardest thing for your stomach
but
yeah, to
But for 40 years and to celebrate that, like you really have something against dairy.
I do. What started that? Well, my parents both died very young. My father died of a heart attack at 52. I was 17 at the time.
That's terrible.
My mother died at 58 of arthritis.
Of arthritis?
The complications, rheumatoid arthritis, the upper vertebrae of her spine disintegrated, shifted out of position, made her paralyzed from the neck down.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
Right before I got taxi, so it was really sad.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
And what's that have to do with dairy?
Well, the more I started studying the human body, and yeah. I went to the Bodhi Tree, if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. The Bodhi Tree Bookstore?
On Melrose.
Yeah, it's
I
where-
I went there. Yeah. Nutrition.
The Earth Cafe is there now, I think,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Or is it across the street? I think it's across the street.
It's close.
But same neighborhood.
Yeah.
Same street. Same block.
So you went to the holistic bookstore.
I went there.
Started
nutritionists.
Yeah.
Doctors. I took human anatomy classes at UCLA.
Out of fear for your life.
I just felt like if my parents can both die in their 50s, and this is the genetic hand we've been dealt, and I've got all these brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know.
Well, how are they doing?
Good, really good.
Are also, they all on the same diet as you?
No, the smart ones. No, the ones who are the most healthy. No, everybody dabbles in it.
Yeah.
Some of them are totally committed.
Polish, how Polish was your dad?
Half.
Yeah?
I mean, no, he was Polish, 100%. Yeah. My mother, 100% Greek.
So it's
a great combination.
It is an interesting conversation.
I'm very lucky.
I don't know if I've ever heard that one before.
Yeah, it's rare. It's rare. I look probably more Polish. Well, people always think I'm Irish and Italian, but
it feels pretty
similar.
Chicago to me,
Chicago.
Polish and Greek
yeah,
for
Chicago.
Some reason. Certainly
real
Polish.
Real neighborhood.
Yeah.
Very neighborhood. My whole neighborhood was very Polish and German. Not too many Greeks. But
a Ukrainian?
A little bit Ukrainian, but mostly.
Where are the pierogies from?
Oh.
Are they Polish?
Polish.
Yeah.
Yeah, pierogies were, you know. But we were very American.
Yeah.
My parents were first generation, but they weren't very Greek and they weren't very Polish.
Religion?
They just Catholic. My mother discovered Catholicism, and that's when she started having all the kids. And so we lived right next door to a Catholic church. And
she discovered it? Was she Greek Orthodox?
She was born Greek Orthodox,
yeah.
And my oldest sister was baptized Greek Orthodox.
Uh-huh.
Then she got into the Catholic church because it was right next door. And so the nuns came over for stretch classes. In their habits.
No.
In their habit. I don't know what happened behind closed doors, but my mother, because my mom... gave them exercises. The nuns' class was private. The kids weren't allowed in. But she also cut their hair.
Uh-huh.
And because she had this beauty shop. But she'd go to the convent to cut their hair.
But it's a beauty shop. What do you mean? You had a couple of those dryers in the house?
We had one dryer where the refrigerator was supposed to be. The refrigerator was down in the basement.
Uh-huh.
And so the blue hair drying chair was in the kitchen. And the whole kitchen was kind of set up like a salon with a, you know how like when you go to a salon and there's like the little tray with the neck?
Yeah.
That was set up in our kitchen. You know, the kitchen was set up like a hair salon.
Now, was this the primary business of the family? Was your mother's?
The dancing school was.
And what'd your dad
do? My father sold, he was a troubleshooter for Ford Motor Company and Chevrolet. He was a car sales, you know, like manager of dealerships.
Oh, yeah?
I think one of the reasons I have a good memory is I had to memorize so many phone numbers because he never stayed at a place for very long. He'd go in there for 3 months, build it up, move to the next, maybe 6 months, build it up, go to the next. My parents were very dynamic and very, you know, full of energy. And my image of my parents growing up is that there was always people laughing at, you know, men lined up to dance with my mother on the dance floor and women in the corner with my father with their heads thrown back in laughter.
Oh.
They looked like Lana Turner and Clark Gable in our minds.
Exciting, yeah.
And then at some point, because we had these big parties, at some point, you know, somebody would put on a rumba and my father would go on the floor and everybody would clear the space and my
He'd
parents would dance. Yeah.
Oh,
so sweet.
Dancing is, that kind of dancing, to know how to dance, it's very kind of exciting.
It is. It's really
I think
fun.
I learned how to do it for my first marriage, my first wedding.
Did you?
We took some ballroom classes, but I didn't stick with it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certain things I think I should stick with because they probably make me feel good, but I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm a dancer.
Yeah. But I bet you have, you seem like you have natural grace.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, yeah. I think I can do it. I'm athletic and I have pretty good rhythm.
What was your sport?
No, I mean, I don't have a sport, but I mean, physique-wise, you know, I work out, I run. And it,
right.
Competitive sports were not my
And you have bag. To sit here for so long. That's why it's like, oh, do
yeah,
you...
Yeah, I don't have back issues. I have knee issues. I have ankle issues. I don't really...
walk well.
I do all right. I'm a little hunched.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a natural hunch because I'm holding my stomach in a lot.
Right.
Because I grew
You're
up with
crunches.
That.
Oh.
My mom was a little bit body dysmorphic.
Oh.
So that was it's a hereditary trait.
I think it's.
I was.
I think it was. I heard you talk about it in one of your podcasts.
You did. One of the many.
No, but I think that that's the generation too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, one of my three mother-in-laws I'm on my third and final husband, every one of my mothers-in-law talked about weight and talked about going on diet pills when they were pregnant or going on, you know, my mother was naturally thin, so she...
One of those people.
Yeah.
The enemy, we call him.
No. I've got I think it's food. I really think it's food. It's so not popular to say that now.
Well,
that
you think
it's
what's
food? I used to weigh 56 pounds more than I do right
Stop
now.
Stop it.
I did at one time. Yeah. In college.
Oh.
I would go up and down, up and down. I was a horrible yo-yo dieter. I'd go on every stupid diet. I talk about this in all of my books because I found a different way of eating that worked for me, and it just, it's like learn to love the food that loves you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call it, because I knew dairy didn't love me. I knew sugar didn't love me. I knew a couple things didn't love me.
I don't
me.
Eat a lot of sugar, but I eat fruit.
Yeah, that's a natural sugar, but it's not like refined sugar, not kiddie cocaine sugar.
No, I don't do much of that.
Mm-hmm.
I like stevia, like almond milk. I make my own almond milk.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's great.
My son's very allergic to nuts and cats too, so unfortunately
really?
We can't have a cat because I always liked cats.
No nuts, no cats.
Yeah, no nuts, no cats.
Those nut allergies are scary.
And I knew it's 7 months old because he had something from a hotel room. We were staying at the Mirage.
And he had to take him to the hospital?
No, but I could tell his whole... But you know what works for... What's the cure-all? Breast milk. Breast milk's unbelievable.
Really?
It is.
Considered dairy, though.
It's like... No. It's not from a cow. Totally different. Totally different chemical makeup and everything.
That's good dairy.
Breast milk. Yes.
So you're dancing.
My uncle lived upstairs with the 10 cats, 2 dogs, 2 birds, a skunk, 150 fish, and his boyfriend Charles. And he taught art at the Catholic grammar school next door. He had art classes going on upstairs while the dancing school was going on, while the beauty shop
was
in the kitchen.
Sounds like the city should have been paying for all this.
They should have. And he was also the neighborhood astrologist, and he ran a cat hospital on our roof. So we had all this going on.
Are you shitting me?
This is totally true.
This
is how
movie?
I grew up.
Why didn't you write this
script?
I
know. I should write this movie. It's so crazy the way I grew up, and people go,
it sounds
are
like
you
a
kidding
play.
Me?
It sounds like a play.
It's a lot of people. Well, it's like you can't take it with you.
Exactly.
Because there's so much going on.
Exactly.
But it gave us such an outlook, and my mother and my uncle were so obsessed with old movies and culture and theater and opera and everything else that we would be exposed to all of that.
And gayness.
And gayness. Oh, I knew that they were a couple. He had his arm around him at dinners. Their beds were pushed together. You know,
so you grew up with tolerance and embracing
people. Do you want to know something? I was 21 years old
and
in the First National Company of Greece, and I was in Boston. I was in another city in Toronto, and I got a birthday card that said, "Love Uncle Dan and Charles." And one of the girls in the show, she said, "Love Uncle Dan and Charles. Is your uncle gay?" And I said, yeah, it's like there was no label to us,
right?
You know,
so
they had the most successful relationship of any of the relationships in our whole family. They were together the longest, and they're buried next to each other. And
how do you have a pet skunk, though? Is a big question.
He got it. He deodorized it. You know, you take the little sack off.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a nice animal.
So cute. Jet.
What was all the fucking animals? So how did they live up there? Did it smell like shit all the time? It sounds like a fucking zoo.
No, he kind of cleaned it up. And we were the godparents. Each one of us got a cat. Mine was Chiffon, a little calico cat.
Uh-huh.
It was so cute.
And this was going on in the upstairs.
The dancing school. all of this went on all the time. And it's just the way
and there
it
were
was.
Five of you.
Six.
Six of you.
Six of us.
And this was all going on.
This was all going on. So I grew up with a very kind of theatrical upbringing.
Yeah.
And people would call... you know, colleges, high schools, community theaters would call the house and want kids for
dancing?
A show.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, I was always like the first one with her hand up. So I would, I got to do a lot of shows.
You had connections.
I had connections. Yeah. So I started doing a lot of community theater. And then when I was 15, I did like a very famous production of The Boyfriend in Chicago. I was the youngest kid by far, person by far. It was
like a big theater production?
Yeah, it was community theater, but it was like a very well-respected one.
Right.
And then one of the guys that I met who was in the advertising agency, quite a bit older, he called me and he said, Henner, I've written the show. It may never get off the ground. We're going to perform it in a converted trolley barn. I wrote it about the kids I went to high school. It's called Grease. So I did the original company of Grease in Chicago.
Before it got to New York?
Before anything.
Oh, wow.
So I did that.
He wrote all the music and everything?
He and his partner, Warren Casey. It was Jim Jacobs and then Warren Casey. And so the first day of rehearsal, we walked in and it was like two stacks about 9 inches tall. One of them was songs and the other one was scenes. And he'd pass out the scenes.
Who were you?
Do you know the play or the movie?
I feel like I saw the play when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in New York. I don't know. Like, I remember that.
When were you? I don't.
September 27th, 1963.
Oh, you were born on a Friday.
Okay. Are you sure? I thought it was a Thursday night. It was a Friday? Okay.
It might have been after midnight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really? September 27th, 1963 is a Friday?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I believe you.
Pretty sure. That's all just off the top of my head. So he wrote it about these kids from school.
I think I remember the sexy tough one. And I remember
Rizzo
was funny. And then, like, I can't remember who played who.
It opened in New York, 72, February 14th of 72. And so you might have seen it if you saw the original company. And then it moved to Broadway. So it was at the Eden Theater.
Who played Rizzo on Broadway?
Adrienne Barbeau.
Mm. And who played the good girl?
Carol Demas.
I wonder who I saw.
But you might have seen Barry Bostwick, maybe?
I really can't remember. Who'd you play?
I played Marty, who was in it, who sang Freddie My Love.
Oh, yeah.
And his boyfriend went off in Missouri.
She had the one who I saw do it had a really nasally voice.
No, that might have been Frenchie.
Oh, Frenchie, that's Frenchie.
Frenchie with the red hair
stuff. Yeah.
I wore a blonde wig. And,
okay.
You know, she was like the one who was very flirty with everybody, sort of a Marilyn Monroe wannabe.
Oh, okay.
And flirted with the disc jockey who came to do the, So here I am. I'm doing the show in Chicago. The show goes to Broadway. My father had just passed away, so I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to go to New York and audition. And then I get a call. I went to University of Chicago on 4 scholarships. So because I was like
4 scholarships for dance, hair, animals.
Yes. Yes, and just social, just personality.
What were the scholarships?
National Merit, National Honor Society. Oh. I was named Outstanding Teenager of Illinois. Which is kind of cool. Yeah, well, I knew how to fill out a good resume. No, I was an overachiever as a kid.
And what'd you do in college?
I did a lot of plays, but you couldn't get a theater degree, so I was going for a political science. But I placed out of a lot of classes, so I would have graduated in 3 years. But then, at the beginning of my third year, I get a call from Jim Jacobs who says, we're casting the National Company. It starts rehearsal tomorrow. I've saved the part for you. Please come to New York today. You have to come to get the job. I said, I'm on my way to the library. I have 2 papers due. I'm in a relationship. Thank you for thinking of me. Hang up the phone. And I walked to the library, and my car was parked in front of the library. And I thought, is this a sign? Because it was never parked there. And I thought, I'm going. So I looked at both. I went to the airport. Flew student standby. Remember, maybe you were too.
Kinda,
And got the job, and so showed up at the first rehearsal. And in that room was Jeff Conaway was playing Danny Zuko.
Sure.
And do you know who Judy Kaye is? She won the Tony Award.
I think
Award.
I saw him as him. Is
oh,
that
it's
possible?
Danny. Yeah, that's very possible. And Jerry Zaks just directed My Fair Lady, directs like everything on Broadway. He was playing Kinnicky.
Yeah.
Michael Lembeck, who did the original Everybody Loves Raymond, he was playing Sonny. And John Travolta was playing Duty.
Yeah.
So, and Richard Gere was rehearsing with us to play Danny in London. So
what year is this?
This is November the 28th of 1972.
So none of these guys were known guys.
Oh, nobody. No, and they were all like 4 or 5 years older than Johnny and I.
All right, yeah. So let's talk about Travolta for a minute, since you don't seem to care about talking about people. You know,
in the good ways.
Yeah. Well, all right. So
you made it. All of a sudden you got so serious. Oh, my God. It's like,
relative,
do I have to put this light in my face?
Well, I'm just curious, like, relative to, you know, what he's become, which is, you know, he's still John Travolta, but there's a lot of mystery and weirdness about him. What was he like as a kid?
He and I immediately got along because we're both from families of 6 kids.
Yeah.
We both have 2 brothers and 3 sisters, because he's from a family of 3 and 3 and I'm 2 and 4. So we both have 2 sisters, yeah, and 3 brothers. His mother taught drama. My mother taught dance. His father sold tires. My father sold cars.
Uh-huh.
We both grew up in these lower middle class neighborhoods, but thought we were the cultural center of our neighborhood,
uh-huh,
you know, and just grew up singing and dancing and performing and everything else. He was, during that time, like my best friend, because we were very familial and very comfortable with each other and just took to each other right away.
Are you still friends?
Yeah, not as much. You know, unfortunately.
Things,
I think,
get
Scientology
weird. Something took him away?
I think so. I don't know.
Yeah.
I
mean, that's been a long time already. But this
I know when he it happened over time.
Yeah. Yeah. But you guys were, you never dated? You weren't romantic?
Oh yeah, on and off for 13 years.
For 13 years,
on and off. Mm-hmm.
But he's,
we lived together for a while. He's just, he's a great guy. I mean,
sweet
our family's
guy.
Very close. Would
you know
travel
his family?
With them very well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, would travel back and forth. You know, went to spend a lot of holidays together, our families and
stuff.
So
these were your young, like, formative love years.
Yeah,
with
really
John Travolta.
But yes, but we were, I would say we were always more friends and siblings than lovers. I mean, we were lovers, but we were
Was that
definitely...
always the weird rub of it? Like,
no,
you were too good
no,
of friends?
No, because we could stay up all night talking.
Yeah.
He reminded me of my brothers.
Yeah.
You know, I reminded him of his sisters. And he's a great guy. He's a great, great guy.
Oh, that's sweet. Like, I never ask people about this stuff, but it just, I'm curious about what these, since your memory's so good, what these people were like when they were younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, no, Richard Gere,
funny.
I don't
know. Oh, Richard was fantastic. Well, Richard I knew from the Grease days, but then my first movie that, I came out here in 77 to do a screen test. I came out in April to do a screen test for a movie called Blood Brothers.
Right.
Which was, and he ended up getting the part opposite me, and he was fantastic. So we got to be friendly then, and whenever we see each other at some function or something,
it's like
we're right back there.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But okay, so you do the national touring thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With Grease.
It was so much fun. And it was like, I'm back in my hometown, and, you know, at a theater that I'd gone to as a little girl and wanted to be there. And I went to New York one weekend to visit a friend of mine who was doing Grease on Broadway. And she had me meet her at the theater because she had a singing lesson. And I walk in and they're auditioning for a new Broadway show called Over Here, which I had heard about, but I didn't think there was a part for me. And I get on stage, I audition, and a week later they flew me back and I got the part.
Musical.
Musical.
You like the musicals?
I love to sing and dance.
Yeah.
I love all of it.
Yeah.
I love all of it.
So you do that for how long?
I did that a year.
Mm-hmm. And so now you're like
in New York,
a known thing.
Well, I started getting an agent and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So people, you know, they send you. I auditioned for 40 commercials before I got one because I finally figured out how to land a commercial.
How's that?
But then I did 72 of them.
So how do you land a commercial?
You have to go in and be yourself. That's it.
Don't act.
That's the hardest thing for people to learn.
Yeah.
You were talking about that in one. I feel like I'm a student of yours now because I've been listening to your podcasts for a few days. I was so excited to be on this. You have no idea.
I
know so many of the people that you talk about in interviews.
And yeah, so is there any corrections that need to be made?
Just a couple. No.
Okay. Like who? Who did you listen to that you know?
Well, I love David Letterman.
That
I remember
was
the
great.
First time I met him.
Yeah.
That was November 22nd, 1979,
uh-huh.
He was hosting The Tonight Show, and I came on, and we just, I did his show like 14 times.
Yeah.
I love him.
Yeah.
And Jay, of course.
And, you know, Jay. But you said that you met Jay and he took you to the comedy store.
Okay, he, and you were talking about, and Letterman was talking about the fact that he was so good. And I remember some of his things. One of the things he did was about being a college student and you couldn't have a microwave. You couldn't cook in your room.
Yeah.
And it was like the cops, oh, come on now, we know you got soup in there.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure he did that for years. But it was interesting because we hung out all day, went to the comedy store.
Did you say you were put together for what reason, that you were auditioning for something?
Oh, American Hot Wax, which I was totally wrong for. I kept saying,
you in that?
No. Fran Drescher got the part and she was perfect.
Alan Freed movie?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've always had like a very producer head.
Yeah.
And so when I think I'm wrong for something, I'm the first person to say, don't get me.
Yeah.
Get this other person.
Yeah.
I've probably talked myself out of many jobs that way.
Did you do movies before you did TV?
I did some work in New York. But then I got cast in the film with Richard Gere, came out here to do this.
Yeah.
A casting director really liked me and kept bringing me in for everything. And they brought me in for Taxi.
Yeah.
And I was totally wrong for the part because at the time I was 25. They wanted a 35-year-old Italian New Yorker.
Yeah.
Who could have a 16-year-old daughter.
Right.
And but they liked me and they thought I could hold my own with the guys.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted, and in the meantime,
yeah,
I had done the pilot for Paper Chase and did it as a guest star. And then I tested so high, they thought, what, we only have her as a guest star? So then it was great because Taxi was like, well, we still want this 35-year-old girl and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And they said, well, okay, you're going to lose her to Paper Chase then. So they went, okay, she's Elaine.
Oh, thank God.
So then
God
they
for
made
Paper
it
Chess,
to, yeah.
Which you didn't.
I know. It's like those happy
which didn't even last as a show,
three
did
years.
It? Oh, it did?
3 years.
That's
we were
not
five.
Bad.
Taxi was five.
Only
Chase
five.
Was three.
Seems like Taxi
feels
was
like
on
a,
forever.
I know. We did so
it was
many.
Such a powerful presence culturally.
We had so much fun.
Judd Hirsch played the dad on my show. He played my dad.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
He's intense, huh?
He is intense, and I was worried
so
about it.
Yeah, oh, really?
Yeah, because like my concern was when we were able to get him. I mean, this is only a few years ago.
Yeah.
Was that he'd be too Jewy and too soft because my dad's a little aggravated and a little
bipolar.
Oh
my God. That's where he lives.
I know.
Aggravated and oh my God, he must have been amazing.
Well, once we made the adjustment, because like he does sort of settle into like, you know, a Judd Hirsch thing that sort of, you know, like it wasn't as aggressive, but like right when, I just remember there was this moment where I'm like, he's doing it. He's being too cute and he's kind of, you know, he's just doing this Jew thing.
Really?
And we were like, someone's got to tell him. My dad's a little nuts.
Oh, Judd is one of the most intense people I've ever met in my entire life. I mean,
yeah.
Once
we made the adjustment,
oh,
it was right there.
Like,
yeah.
He's fabulous. He's a fabulous actor. I learned watching him and Danny DeVito just take a script that was, you know, I mean, there were no bad taxis, but there were some that were much better than others and some that in the beginning of the week you'd think like, oh. And they were just masters.
And Christopher Lloyd, too, is like a trip.
Lloyd. He came in as a guest star, and they just loved him so much, they just made him a regular the following year.
And what about Andy?
Andy. I loved Andy. I was so disappointed in Man on the Moon. So, so, so disappointed.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
I thought, well, now that I've seen the documentary with
right,
Jim and
makes
Andy,
more
it was
sense.
Like, well, Jim had his own
how
thing
are you
gonna, going.
Like, how, but any biopic... I mean, the problem is if the guy is, you know him, if the world knows him, it's already, you know, you're already working at a disadvantage.
Yeah.
How are you going to do that guy?
Yeah, but I also think that they made the choice to make him so crazy all the time and not sweet. And Andy's genius was that he knew what he was doing all the time. And he was like this sweet boy from Long Island who could have like serious conversations with you and be so adorable.
Yeah.
And then do something crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and that was like the yin yang of that was.
But
so
you did,
appealing.
you were part of the, you were in Man on the Moon.
Yeah, Man on the Moon. Yeah, I wore the same clothes. I still have them.
And what now, but like why, I mean, there's all this mythology that I think was, you know, mostly, what's his name? Who was his partner? I interviewed him for two and a
Bob
half
Zmuda?
Hours. Like Zmuda really kind of like built this myth around him.
Yeah.
But I mean, he was a prankster, but was he really, he knew what he was up to.
He knew what he was up to. I mean, first of all, I know Zmuda since I'm in grade school.
What?
Because we did, Smuta is like, my life is like a Dickens novel anyway. People kind of wander in and out. But Smuta and I was in eighth grade going into freshman year. He was a junior going into senior year. And we ended up at the same Loyola University high school thing.
Yeah.
And we did the boyfriend together.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I go to school and he ends up in my show in high school.
What?
I was a freshman and he was a senior and he ended up playing a part in the Unsinkable Molly Brown.
Yeah.
Then I run into him in New York when I'm doing Grease and he's good friends with somebody in the show.
Yeah.
And then I come out to Hollywood and there he is, Andy's right-hand guy. So I've known Smuta a very long time.
That's crazy.
I know. Crazy, crazy. Yeah. But I think you're right. He had this mythology. But Smuta has that Chicago sort of, let's see what we can get away
with
thing.
The hustler.
The hustler.
Yeah.
And in the best way, you know. And Andy was just, he'd come up with the craziest things. I mean, that whole Tony Clifton thing was insane. And did happen the way it was, only it was even crazier than you saw in the movie if you saw it.
It
was crazy. I mean, imagine that you're working with someone, you really like them, you're working together 3 months, and then all of a sudden your producers say to you, okay, the guest star next week is going to be Andy. Well, it's not Andy, but just play along.
Right.
I was like, oh, okay. All
yeah.
Right. And then he shows up with this fake chest, you know, like padded out with the ruffled tuxedo shirt and the, you know, ice blue tuxedo jacket with a mustache, orange fake nose, wig, and chain smoking, you know, and it's like, hey, pretty lady, hey, mess around, let's get to work here. And he was such a bad actor. Tony Clifton was so bad playing a part. He was going to be playing Louis De Palma's brother. He was, and the episode.
And it was Andy or was it Bob?
It was Andy.
Yeah.
Oh, it was totally Andy.
Yeah.
No, it was always.
Well,
it was
Bob has done.
I
Tony
know, but that's
later.
Yeah, later to sort of carry on this myth that maybe Andy's not dead.
Yeah, but so you all had to play along. It came down
along
from the top
Tuesday, and then went to the run through, and it was so horrible.
Yeah,
you know, I remember some of the lines because it was about Louis De Palma negotiating with his brother who was going to get stuck with their mother for the holidays. And the way he said the lines was like this. You know, Ma, sometimes she's glad, sometimes she's sad. As Jim Brooks said, you can't have a man playing a man playing a man playing a man. It's like, I believe in artists painting, but they can't paint on other artists. They can't paint on the other actors.
Yeah.
And so they fired him, but he said he would only get fired. They called Andy at night and said, Tuesday night, and said, it's just not working out with your friend Tony.
Yeah.
We're going to have to fire him. And he said, can you do it in person? So the next day we came in, Jim Burrows said, who's directing, he said, you know, just play along. We don't know what's going to happen, but here he is. He's going to, you know, this is the new guy.
Yeah.
So he starts, and we're like, okay, finally we can have a show this week.
Yeah.
And then after lunch, out of nowhere, here comes Tony with the two hookers that he was hanging out with all week in his trailer. It's like, okay, where's the director? Let's go. Let's get to work and all this.
Yeah.
You know, and then Judd turns to me and he says, the man wants a psychodrama. He wants a psychodrama. So.
The man being Andy.
Andy. And they started punching each other until the Paramount guards pulled them apart.
But my question is like, why did everyone feel like they had to play along with this? Why would, you know, if Jim called Andy.
That's a good question to ask our country right now. It's like, what, you know, you play, people are fascinated by bad behavior. And I think that.
No, I get it. But like, if everyone knew it was Andy and, you know, and they, why did they indulge Andy Kaufman to that degree?
I think they loved what he was doing as Lotka so much, even though he only had to come in Tuesday afternoon for the run through. They wrote. This, in the script, it said what he was saying, but didn't have the language.
Right.
And Andy, I always use this line. I said, Andy made up a country I wanted to visit.
Right.
Because it was so rich in culture, what he brought in terms of the language and the history of you know, Latka land, whatever it was called. And so they loved what he was doing so much, they didn't want to lose him. And when he signed his contract.
Threat?
No, when he signed his contract, he said, my friend Tony Clifton has to be a guest star. And he wanted three.
Yeah.
And they said, we'll sign him for one.
Right.
So it was like, oh, let's see, you know, we'll play along.
But they were, you know, he had enough leverage to kind of do that, but it was really.
And they were fascinated. I think our guys were fascinated. I think that they thought, like, well, this is kind of funny. This is kind of cool. Let's see what. But then when they realized it was not It was not going to work.
So
they got rid of him.
Was the entire experience of Taxi a good experience?
Fantastic. Oh, such a golden time in all of our lives. And every one of us will say that.
Yeah.
Jim Brooks and Danny and Tony and all of us, we loved it.
We
I always say we had 112 shows. We had 112 parties. We were like the cool kids because it was bosom buddies and Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Working Stiffs, Mork and Mindy. Everybody came and hung out at Taxis. It was like my family. Everybody came out and hung out.
And then was it from Taxi that you were able to do the movies, most of the bigger movies that you did?
Yeah. Went right into
I can't believe there's a fucking wood chipper out there today. I can't tell you how it's fucking annoying me sometimes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm a good guest to have then because it's not annoying me.
Oh, no, I don't even think it picks up on the mics that much, but it's like every fucking day in this neighborhood.
There's something.
In my old neighborhood, I was tucked in the back.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's with all these yards, it's like every day.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's one thing with the blowers, but then it just becomes this thing where like earlier, there was a blower and then there was a second level, which is a wood chipper. And I'm like, what a wood chipper? What is that?
It's Fargo?
Yeah. It becomes like this farce.
I know.
With the goddamn blowers. And then it's like, what is that noise?
When you are at a hotel, do you have to have it quiet or do you have to have it dark?
I don't like there to be a nightclub downstairs or to be on the street where it's like, going till 2 a.m. I like a quiet environment, sure. And I know, I've been doing a podcast from my house one way or the other for a long time. And, and I don't mind texture, but it just makes me sort of it fills me with a type of resentment.
Right.
The gardening equipment in this particular
but
neighborhood.
But you have a beautiful neighborhood.
I understand. I understand. But just one of those days where I think I'm looking for a reason to lose my fucking mind.
Oh, why?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's okay. You could do it in front of me.
Why?
I'm used to people.
Because show business is irritating sometimes.
It is. It's very irritating. You have to get to inner peace and have a good family life a lot sooner these days.
You do?
You do.
Well, you've had this amazingly kind of persistent career in show business.
Well, I think because I haven't messed myself up, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I you know what? It's like, I think because of my parents and the crazy way I grew up, I'm always looking okay, what's over here? What's this? So, I do a lot of different things.
But you did all these fun movies.
Did fun movies.
Yeah, I don't know if some of them weren't huge movies. They were kind of weird movies.
Oh, they were like... Weird, but I did some movies that we thought were going to be huge, and then they weren't.
Like
Johnny Dangerously. That was a heartbreaker.
Yeah, that was that Piscopo and Michael Keaton.
Yeah, and the funniest person I've ever worked with. The two funniest people I have ever worked with.
Yeah.
Griffin Dunne and Ian McShane.
They
will put anybody to shame. They are the funniest two people I have ever worked with in my life.
Both of them having sort of a pretty good few years.
Yeah, for sure.
As older dudes.
How great is Griffin how did he not get a nomination?
For Transparent?
For This Is Us.
He's so good
in that show.
Yeah, yeah. I just realized I rewatched Dallas Buyers Club.
Oh, yeah.
And he plays a doctor.
He's so good. He can do anything, but he is personally the funny. He and Ian McShane, tears roll down your cheeks when you work with these guys. They're unbelievable. I did a movie in the south of France.
I can't even picture Ian McShane as funny.
So funny. So funny. Killer funny.
Which movie did you do with them?
I did a little Showtime movie back then called Grand Larceny with Omar Sharif, Louis Jordan.
It was pretty
cool people.
That's what's interesting about you, too, is that you're at really this weird, a lot of that generation was still around.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, so I got in Hollywood.
And Bert, I worked with Bert 5 times and worked with him for 4 years on a series, but also did The Man Who Loved Women with him and got directed by Blake Edwards and just bonded with him, first moment, laughed, had so much fun with him.
Nice guy.
Oh.
Bert Reynolds.
The best. I loved him so much. What a great guy. But I can't believe we're coming on the 1 year anniversary. Such a special, special person. Just... Really. And it's funny because we never had an affair. We never, had a thing together.
Yeah.
But we just loved each other. Maybe that's why we got to work together so many times. I always think, I say that.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful man.
Yeah.
Special and just so generous.
It is hard to believe he's gone, really.
I know, because you know why it's really hard? Because his parents lived well into their 90s, like 96 and something, and so that he died so young.
How old was he?
Well, he was like 81.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just like there are these people that were always so present in the culture for so long.
I know, and just there.
Yeah, and you just, you know, you don't, their absence, it's sort of like, wow, that's happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you guys stayed close until the end?
We stayed close. Oh. Always called each other on birthdays. And he did my radio show. Uh-huh. And, you know, he talks about me in his book. I talk about him in my book. And, you know, just, I guess that's not so Hollywood. Yeah. That sounds like a stupid thing to say. But, no, but we stay in contact. We stay, you know, it's
well,
the special people.
I'm sorry
people.
For your loss.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What a great guy. He was great. Yeah, I've been very lucky in my career to work with a lot of wonderful people.
L.A. Story you did with Steve Martin.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
My favorite part I've ever played.
Yeah.
Not the most like me. In fact, very unlike me. But Steve gave me free rein. I read the script and I wanted to go in as this character.
Right.
And they said, no, can you read the part of Trudy, the girlfriend?
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm so not dressed. I want to like look like the part. I said, can I do it tomorrow? Because I had therapy, actually. Yeah. So I had therapy on the phone and I wanted to like go to my, you know, go to
Are
my therapy.
Are you still in therapy?
I did 28 years of therapy with a brilliant psychoanalyst who passed away. Mm. And now sometimes my husband and I go to her son. She was such a brilliant therapist.
Yeah.
Her name is Dr. Ruth Velikovsky-Sharon. She would set up Sunday nights at 6:30 LA time, 9:30 New York time, set up six speaker boxes in her place in Princeton, New Jersey. And the six siblings for 10 years, every other Sunday, would do group therapy.
Wow. So 28 years of that type of psychoanalysis.
Loved
and
it.
So when you do that for 28 years and then you do it with your, like what is, because there are some people that will do it, therapy. Mm-hmm. Like, and I've done it on and off my life and I'm very self-examining. But when you sort of stay in that consistent relationship with a therapist, what are you working on?
I always liken it to like, there's always things that come up and there's always so many people.
Yeah, but
and
why
ideas.
Do they need, what do you need them for?
Because it's great to brainstorm with somebody that you trust, that you can, it's like going to a computer and you're asking questions that ask you questions and back and forth and back and forth.
So
and there were just so many people.
But for you, did you have a psychological issues that that needed constant maintenance?
No, new ones come up because I definitely went into it at the time. I felt like I was numb. My mother was still alive, but my father had died.
Uh-huh.
I found myself dating a lot of men that were in other relationships. So I was kind of like a professional other woman.
Uh-huh.
And I found myself not picking impossible people to have a relationship uh-huh. with and then complaining that I couldn't, where is that
right,
guy? You know,
right,
I'm not,
right.
How can I have a relationship?
Right.
You know,
without
it was
blaming yourself.
Without blaming myself.
Yeah.
So it was always easy to leave
yeah.
or say, oh, well, of course it didn't work out. He had uh-huh. a girlfriend or he was crazy or he did this or whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember, and it was just like hard for me to make commitments and things.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I was living up on 83rd Street at the time, and I like went to the 79th Street subway
yeah.
to go downtown.
Yeah.
And I got on, and then we pulled up to 72nd, and I thought, ooh, should I take the express? Stay on the local express, stay on the local.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm going to take the express. So I ran to the express, the doors closed, ran back to the local, the doors closed. And the two trains were like whizzing by me. I'm in the middle of the platform, and I thought, no wonder I'm on my way to therapy. You know, it was like not easy for me to make decisions or to take action. And
uh-huh.
and I just felt like I was so out of touch with my feelings at the time. And then new things come up. You want to become more successful and the problems get bigger and you lose your mom. And, you know,
yeah.
weight is an issue because I was dealing with weight. You know, women, you can't talk to any women. Because we were raised by mothers like your mother, like yeah. my mother. And then, there were issues always with food and stuff until I figured out how to eat.
So really it was about kind of like trying to make better decisions for yourself, accepting who you are and why you make the decisions you do.
You know what it is too? I always thought that I don't want to be a wise old person. I want to be a wise young person. Mm. I want a doctorate on myself. I don't want just an eighth grade or a high school or a college education. I want to know why I do what I do, where that comes from, why am I reactive, what is going on here. And I just felt like, and I just loved it. I loved the process so much. And the more I was getting my siblings into it, the more I could
see. What were you doing?
See.
So you got six speakers set up, so, and you're doing group therapy from different places.
Yeah.
What are you trying to, was it more about the relationships between you guys or what you happened in your childhood?
Everything, everything.
Huh.
I mean, we had a very tragic situation with my father and one of my brothers that I was talking about a little bit earlier. We were having a Christmas party at our house. I was 17. He was 16. My sister was 15. My brother was 12. My two older sisters were like 27 and 23. Big Christmas party, all the dancing students, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
My brother got into some liquor that my father had been given as a Christmas gift. He started mouthing off to one of the guests. My father made him go in the house. I see my sister. I'm at the party. I see my sister run out, get my mother. I follow them. My brother and father are arguing. My brother is like hitting him. My father's got him down. He's hitting him. My mother separates them. My father slumps into a chair and has a heart attack and dies. And that's how he dies. So we had things to deal with in my family, you know?
Yeah.
And so.
And that was the core of it for everybody.
That was, well, part of it.
Well,
that was part of it.
But everyone was there.
Everyone was there. We had 100 people in our dance studio and all through our house and everything else. And it was just
and
very.
And then your brother probably had what feelings of
he was
guilt?
16, sure. You know, all kinds of things. So, you know, things got shoveled under the. I mean, we've always been a very verbal family, very like people, you know, have incredible conversations. Our favorite thing to do is sit around and talk.
Right.
But we had issues and we had to like deal with certain things. And then things come up in our own lives that you want to bring to the group and sort of talk to them about.
Right.
You know?
And you were 17?
I was 17. I just turned 26.
And it was tragic. It was quick.
Tragic. And horrible. And like overnight. Like, yeah. Like our life turned on a dime. And what's crazy is that if I were writing a story about this family and there were certain signs along the way, you know, just little conversations and things, you know, my dad was not in the health of, I'll give you an example. I was filling in one of the scholarship things and my father filled in the financial and I filled in the personal information. And I said, oh, let me check it. And he said, no, that's okay. And he sent it in. I got it back in the mail 2 days after he died. And they wanted my mother's age because nobody was ever sure of my mother's age. So I left it blank and he left it blank.
Yeah.
Just because we thought the other one filled it
in.
But what my father had written was they said, do you, you know, if you expect decrease in income. And so he had a different income for the following year written down.
Yeah.
And he wrote, expect decrease in salary because of decrease in health. Angina pains are more frequent and severe. So he knew. So.
And do you find that after, like, through all this process, like, are you guys very close now?
Oh, yeah. Super close. All of us. We get together at Christmas, and we all block off 5 days to a week and do such incredible things together. We have, you know, there's always some kind of food crawl that it starts with. We did an Anthony Bourdain food crawl last time. We do a Christmas survey. We do Secret Santa. I do the cooking for Christmas. We go to somebody else's house.
Yeah.
We do some kind of sports event.
That's great.
We're super close. And now the family number's, you know, in 32 or 33 or something.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's got kids and kids have got kids probably.
Kids, my oldest sister. You want to hear something crazy in my family? My oldest sister's daughter, because we're a 15-year spread. My oldest sister's daughter is 54. My brother's, who's 15 years younger than she is, than the sister, his daughter's 4. So there's a 50-age spread.
Wow.
50-year age spread in that second tier.
That's so crazy.
It's crazy.
So now, you doing Dancing with the Stars makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you did it.
I did it. That was one of the hardest things of my life.
Really?
It was hard because for a lot of different reasons, but yeah, it was really intense. My mission was to stay on the show.
Because of competitive reasons?
No, I think I had the wrong partner at the time.
Who was your partner?
Derek Huff. He was in a tough time in his life. He was I don't think we were a match.
Oh.
And so, unfortunately.
So you had to deal with a little more emotional baggage than you prepared.
Well, I knew, I mean, he was doing two jobs, so the schedule was based around him rather than...
What was he going through in his
life?
He was
going through... No. He was going through hairspray. He was going through hairspray, but he was also going through... I think he expected to come back and have it. I mean, yeah.
Okay. All right. But, okay.
Yeah.
So, and then, but The Apprentice, too.
Yes.
Now, when you do these things, are you doing it to stay, do you like the work or you need the work?
No. They don't pay you enough on Apprentice, believe me.
You just wanted to.
You lose money.
And you did it when Trump was the guy.
Yeah, it was fun. I was the first person they called for Celebrity Apprentice because I know Chuck LaBelle and I knew Mark Burnett.
Yeah.
So they called me and they said, would you do, and Donald was on the phone too. And it was a blast. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And it was so much fun. And it was so crazy, and you get no sleep, but you really prove what you can do to yourself, I think.
And you had a relationship with Donald, that was show business.
Yeah, that was show business.
No, but I mean like before he is the president.
Yeah.
Now, as somebody who knew him as this guy that had this reality show,
right?
What were your feelings about him?
Well,
at
he was
that time.
Certainly fun in the show,
uh-huh.
And he was totally fascinated by my memory. So every show, you didn't see it because they, of course, cut it out. But every boardroom, he'd have me tell him what happened and what. I mean, he was always like, Mary Lou, if I take you to Vegas, you know, could you count cards and stuff? You know, it was like right. He was so. Okay. I mean, he was
of
like.
Of course, that's what he does.
Somebody would say what happened on a task, and he'd say, "Mary Lou, is that true? Because you're the one with the memory." You know, I have a good memory too. But you have my memory's not. I can't do the dates thing, but yeah. I have an excellent. You know,
it's so funny.
But anyway, he'd be like, he'd say something totally inappropriate, and he'd say, "Eric, cut that out." And I'd say, "I don't know. That's kind of funny." He'd say, Eric, leave that in. But I'll tell you something. He was fascinating because he used no notes.
Yeah.
And he was off the cuff. And he was kind of like fun and wacky. If someone had told me that 4 years to the day after I was fired from a fake job, from a fake boss on a fake show, that he would be president of the United States, no way would I have believed it.
And how do you sort of assimilate that in your head? With the, like knowing that guy and having that kind of relationship, because most of the people I know, comedians and stuff who knew him, they're like, yeah, he was kind of a clown and, funny and he made you feel good.
Yeah. He's very charming. He's very charming. He tripped once in front of me. He's like, oh, she's going to remember that. You know, he was like sort of
very quick.
Very quick. Yeah, he was really fun. I never expected him to be president.
No,
I never expected him to be like the president he is.
Yeah.
At all. I thought he'd be much kinder and more conscious and more,
Do you think he only gives a shit about himself?
I think he goes where the action is. I think if everybody, loved him over on the Democratic side, he'd go there. I think he, So, yeah, I don't even think I think he goes where the action is. He goes where's the crowd. And he knows how to stir people up.
That's for sure.
He knows how to stir people up. But I hate all the racism. I hate all the misogyny. I hate, and he was no more inappropriate in the boardroom or than most guys of that generation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But he was so, the idea of the children at the borders and the families, I did not expect that from him at all. I didn't expect him to turn into that guy.
Yeah.
And he goes with the fan base that wants that.
Yeah.
So that's what he does. And I think that people, there's must be some kind of puppet master, although he doesn't want to think that there is.
There's several.
Several.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to concern himself with that shit.
Of course,
he doesn't know what he's doing. He just wants to be out in front of the people.
They didn't expect to win. He didn't expect to win.
Yeah, but he's the guy, but he's no thinker. So he's like, he's got all these monsters, and
yeah,
I'm not even being an apologist. It's just that, you're right. He's going for the crowd that they're really horrible. And then he's got people that are, Republican policy dudes and religious fanatics who are just like, he's like, I don't want to deal with that. Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I'll keep these people.
He likes the crowd.
People worked up.
However he can keep them worked up. Yeah, I'm surprised. I'm saddened by Ivanka because I loved her. And we had a nice relationship. And
it's hard to picture them as even regular. They're not even like, what kind of people are they?
I know. I mean, that so many things are going on right now, and just the bullying. It's so crazy making that how do you wrap your head around it?
I just think that they're so insulated that they really don't give a fuck. It's just that, like, ultimately, whatever policies outside of environmental, which is going to affect everybody,
yeah.
he knows that none of it's going to touch him.
Right.
He doesn't have
it's
to.
Not gonna, yeah, exactly.
It has no effect on his life.
But you know what it is, too? Is, you know, as an actor, you're always trying to figure out what's your want in the scene.
Yeah.
What does everybody want in the scene? He just wants to stay in front of the crowd. He wants to stay with people cheering and yelling. He turns every appearance into people, you know, cheering and yelling.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, he doesn't care.
That's his want.
Yelling, lock her up, or kick her out, or whatever it is.
Yeah,
But
it was fun. I had a great time. I made a lot of money.
Okay, good.
For Alzheimer's Association.
Yeah.
And the first time for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine.
Yeah.
You know? And so.
That's great.
Yeah.
So now the books. Now this has been your journey through getting healthy, and you know, learning a different way to live. And because you did position yourself as sort of a self-help person,
yeah,
for a while.
Of course.
Yeah.
No.
For sure,
therapy can be self-help. You know, is that what you're?
No. I mean, like when you write books about diet, about
totally.
That kind of stuff.
No, totally. I was doing Chicago on Broadway and writing a book at the same time because you know, God forbid, there's any downtime, even with a 2-year-old and a 3.5-year-old. But you know, I was like so revved up from all the Fosse afterwards that the kids were asleep. So I'd go to an office and work with somebody who was, you know, taking notes, and we were brainstorming and making tapes and stuff like that. And I finished the show and the book came out and immediately went on the first book and went on the New York Times bestseller list. Well, it was the first health book. I had written an autobiography.
What was the first health book called?
Total Health Makeover.
Mm.
Yeah, and it was on the list for a very long time. It was great. I was really, it just gave me another whole career.
Now, these things, do you tour with them? Do you ever go out and do the talks or what?
Oh, all the time. At least 10 times. I'm going to Spartanburg, South Carolina next week, and I was just in San Diego. I'm going to San Diego again. I go all over the
country. What's the name of the talk?
I do different talks because I wrote a memory book, but then also my husband, that's another whole story.
Yeah.
He and I knew each other in college. He was my roommate's boyfriend.
This is your third husband.
Third and final.
Yeah.
He was my roommate's boyfriend.
Yeah.
We ran into each other in a courthouse in New Orleans when I was getting married to Freddie Forrest. I was getting
that long ago. Right.
Getting the marriage license and ran into Michael in the hallway. He was just passing through, married with kids and stuff, but we always liked each other. And as he walked from me, I thought, how come I'm not marrying a guy like that? Didn't bode well for my first marriage. But anyway, so what happened was we reconnected 16 and a half years ago, got together. Within a week, we're saying, I love you. You're the love of my life. And
you were both divorced?
Yeah. Mm. 2 months later, he's diagnosed with bladder cancer and then lung cancer. And I said, failure's not an option. You're the love of my life. I know like the best people that integrative medicine. And to make a very long story short, no chemo, no radiation. He didn't lose his bladder. He didn't lose his prostate. They were telling us the guy was going to take out his bladder and his prostate and make a neobladder with his intestines and hose up his penis so that if we wanted to have sex, we can pump it up 6 times. And I said, can we have the 7-pump model? Because we're a sexy couple.
Yeah.
And he said, I said, what about nutrition, health, detox? He said, have all the steak and highballs you want. Then we'll do chemo and radiation. And then he found out he had lung cancer as well because they did a body scan. 2 separate sites, 2 primary sites. He totally nursed himself back to health. He did have he was very lucky with the lung cancer because it was bronchial alveolar, which is a very slow growing cancer. And it was in a very specific spot of his lower right lobe. So right lung, and they took it out from the side.
Yeah.
And but he never did chemo or radiation. He did immunotherapy for the bladder, and he's almost 16 years in remission this November. So
no chemo, but immunotherapy. There was definitely medicine involved.
Oh, yeah. But total detox. He did total detox. Everything from getting rid of the fillings in his teeth, chelation therapy, totally vegan diet, lots of supplementation, infrared saunas because they get it on the cellular level because a lot of the poisons are in your fat. So they kind of clean that out. Lymphatic massages, high colonics. I mean, he did everything, and he continues to do a lot of these things because he's maintained it. And And he's been in remission. It'll be November 24th. It'll be 16 years.
Well, that's congratulations.
Both. Yeah. So we wrote a book about that. So we both go sometimes around the country, or I go to talk to a lot of cancer groups about Michael's protocol and how, our journey through all of that. But I would have to say that most of the things I do now are, you know, in terms of speaking, have to do with memory, health, and cancer.
What do you say about memory?
Well, I talk about the fact that no matter how bad people think their memory is, it's so much better than they realize. But you just have to know how to grab onto it. Because we just have, people who have my kind of memory, we just have an extraordinary retrieval system.
Uh-huh.
But all your memories are inside of you. They're all part of you and on your emotional hard drive.
Yeah.
Knock this over. They're on your emotional hard drive. Everybody has a primary track, what I call a primary track.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in the jigsaw puzzle of your life, what are the hard-edged pieces by which you can interlock the other pieces mm-hmm. to? And so, you know, for a lot of people, it might be gigs that you've played, relationships, places you've lived.
Everything's becoming sort of a mush.
Well, because you're in the same place every day, probably.
No, I've been in too many different places. And mm-hmm. I can't place people. Like, I don't, like, there are chunks of my life that took place in New York, Boston, San Francisco.
But that should be easier for you.
Kind of.
Because memory happens in chunks.
I guess so, but like, I don't, when if someone comes up to me and they're like, hey, you know, I've met so many people,
yeah.
and I used to be pretty good at remembering faces, but some of it's just lost.
Is it pre the 20 years? Is it this sobriety?
Sure, some of it, yeah.
So it's like two different realities?
I guess. No, it's just like, I don't know what's really going on with me. It just seems like some things are getting very far away.
Hmm.
You
yeah.
know, and I think that, and I'm also overwhelmed and busy all the time. And I think it just becomes hard to, you know, like I'm so, everything in the present, but I feel like I'm losing things.
Mm. But are you naturally pruning or do you choose to prune? Or
my
do
memory?
You think like, yeah, because that's a lot of times people, you know, prune away. Because they don't want to.
I don't know if I don't think I'm doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems like there were different lives I lived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they should be almost easier to track.
No, I mean, can track them to a degree.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, the saddest thing that I learned through all of this mm-hmm. memory stuff was that in any given year of someone's life, most people remember only 8 to 11 things that happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is just crazy. Because I can't even imagine that. I can't imagine only hanging on to 8 to 11 things that happened within a year. So if I said to you, you know, 2003 or 1997 or, mm-hmm. you know, 2016 or whatever, that most people would only remember 8 to 11. So that's like, what
it's bizarre,
does that
right?
mean? Yeah.
And you can remember everything from every day.
Mm-hmm, pretty much. Yeah, some things take a little bit longer, but some things are so the day of the week just comes up automatically. I don't even know how. It just it's there.
Yeah.
And it just comes up and then it starts to fill in all the details and it gets deeper and deeper the more I start, you know, thinking about it.
Like if I set a date, you could do
yeah,
that?
Tell me a date. As long as I'm conscious, not before I'm born. Because people go, what about 1800? You know, or could you go back in a memory and like you're in the room, but you go around the door and go, I can't bend time. I'm not going to be able to.
Well, let's say like, okay, so let's say like August 9th, 1999.
Okay, August 9th. August 9th, 1999. 99, August 9th was a Monday. Look it up.
Okay, I believe you.
Yeah.
What was going on with you that day?
I was doing Chicago in... Oh, I know exactly what I was doing. Oh, my gosh. We went to see Siegfried and Roy that day at the Mirage. I was doing Chicago, August 9th, 1999. We ate at Cherco the night before.
Uh-huh.
And we ate, of course, in at the Mirage the day of August uh-huh. 9th. Yeah. Off that day.
How was it?
I had a green top on.
Yeah.
And a green, yeah.
Oh, wow. And you went with your kids?
I went with my kids and my husband, and we had a big fight.
Yeah. Seriously?
That was my second husband, yeah.
About Siegfried and Roy?
No.
That's sort of fascinating that you can do that, huh?
Mm-hmm. It's fun for me.
And you have a certain type of thing?
What do you mean? What is it called?
Yeah.
It's called HSAM, Highly Superior Autobiographical Memory. And they've taken 300 measurements of our brains, and they found 9 areas, 10 times larger than the normal brain.
Uh-huh.
And there's very few people in the world who have this.
Yeah.
There's a group in the 99th percentile, and they've relaxed some of the criteria because they needed more money for research. And there were so few people.
Do you know the others?
I met a couple of them. Because of the 60 Minutes thing, I don't know if you saw that.
I heard about it, yeah.
Yeah. It's been life-changing. Because, you know, you just grow up with this thing. You don't even know it's that weird. You don't realize how few people have it. And then all of a sudden, people are talking about it, and you're in medical books, and people are testing you. And
well, that's very entertaining, and it must have something to do with your energy level as well, I guess. I don't know what exactly.
Well, memory is tied to adrenaline.
Yeah.
That's why people remember the highs and the lows.
Right.
But I'm trying to...
But you just have them
remember.
All at the old. You have all of it all the time. It's all
Are you
happening
making on, fun of me?
No,
I couldn't wait to do your show. I was more excited, almost as excited as when I went on the Tonight Show with Sting, which was maybe my
what
most
day was
memorable.
That?
May 13th of 1993. It was a Thursday, and I was on with Jay, and I found out Sting was going to be on. I totally embarrassed myself, and I didn't care. I just had to, and people to this day stop me about that.
What'd you do?
Oh, my God. I said to him, I was so excited. I was like, you know, I love you. I couldn't wait to meet you.
Sting.
I said to Sting. Yeah. And I wanted to smell him.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I said, you know how I wrote in the book? I said, I wanted to write on the page next to you. Mercedes Ruehl was there. So I turned the thing over. I wrote, please. And I wrote on the other side. I said, please keep this book closed so that Sting is always on top of me.
Yeah.
You know, I said things like that.
Was he a nice guy to you?
You shut up. Yes.
He doesn't strike me as a terrific. He seems like a little
standoffish.
Something.
He was very nice. He was very nice.
Well, I'm glad. It's nice when somebody loves you as a fan to be at least cordial.
Well, you want to be. Yeah. Have you had people like come up to you and then did you feel accosted by me at the theater?
No, not accosted. No, I was happy to see you, and I was happy.
You weren't very
that,
friendly backstage when you went to talk to Annette Bening, and
I was standing there with Annette Bening. I have a lot going on there.
Okay. Well, I didn't.
Was I nice in the theater? I was.
I never thought I'd hear from you again.
Really?
Yes, because you weren't that friendly. But that's okay.
Uh-huh.
Now I see how friendly you are and how good you are.
I'm very good with my fans and people that know me. I try to be gracious and nice. You know, if I'm not, it's only because you know I'm tired or I've been through. You know, sometimes.
Sure.
You know, you're trying to have a day, you know.
Of
you know
course.
That.
Oh, yeah. I know what it's like. No, I mean, I probably hosed you too much about what a fan I was to say, I want to be on your show.
How did it go? Do you feel this show went good?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I think so.
No, I think it did too. But if you were so excited about it, I don't want you to leave going like, that wasn't a good experience. That was a letdown.
And it's funny that, well, first of all, I'm a little disappointed we're not in your garage because of my garage roots.
Well, I'm sorry to let you down on the garage.
No, I'm teasing you. But also, WTF is something that we used to say at taxi all the time.
Mm.
Like if there was, we used to have two phrases. One of them was if all of a sudden you thought, like, what does that joke mean? We'd call it joke obscura.
Yeah.
Joke obscura, and we'd point to our script. And the other one was like if something took you out of it, it was a what the fuck.
Yeah.
So that you had to like a WTF and we'd write it in our scripts. Because if like the person who's watching the show has to turn to the person next to them, like, what did they just say? Or, you know,
right,
whatever.
Right, right.
What did that mean? So we were always trying to avoid joke JOs and WTFs
in
our scripts.
Well, yeah,
so
I'm glad
that
you
reminds
didn't,
me of it.
Yeah, I'm glad you didn't avoid this one.
No, I didn't, of course. And the other funny thing that, you know, I told you I did the original Grease in Chicago, but my mother wouldn't come to see it because I said, fuck you in it 7 times, my character. And she just didn't like me swearing. She said, you can take all your clothes off, but you can't swear. But she saw the Broadway version that I did and the on the road version, and she saw it. And I still said a lot of fuck yous.
And she was okay.
She acclimated. Her daughter was in show business. Are you kidding? Her dream.
She acclimated to the fuck yous.
She loved it.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you. Thanks for coming.
Nice talking to you, too.
There you go. And you know what? She was right. She was right. My birthday was on a Friday. There you go. I'm going to play some guitar now. I have been listening to a little bit too much Modu Mukhtar. Yeah. Maybe you can hear it in you know what? I'm going to go. All right. Enjoy yourselves.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.